Welcome to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Tom, on social media, who could miss the Me Too hashtag this year? Time magazine called them the silence breakers. Women coming forward telling stories of workplace harassment, assault, and worse. And this fall, a powerful Florida Republican was the target of sexual harassment allegations, too. Half a dozen women accused Jack LaValla of groping or sexual harassment. A Senate investigation referred those allegations for a criminal probe, finding his actions may constitute public corruption. Now, before the release of the new special master's report on all this, LaValla maintained he did nothing wrong.
I haven't pounded on anybody to support me in this. I'm stating my case, talking the facts, producing signed, notarized, sworn affidavits. And I'm not going down the political realm.
LaValla says at 66 years old, he's close to the end of his political career, and he's not going to admit to something he says he didn't do. Melissa, he took his own lie detector test back in the fall. His lawyers released more than 200 text messages between him and one accuser who went public, Senate aide Rachel Perrin Rogers. But the Senate Special Master Report decided there's enough evidence for the Senate Rules Committee to hold a hearing to figure out if LaValla violated the chamber's rules. And in addition, the report recommends that law enforcement launch its own look into LaValla's behavior, including a new accuser and allegations of trading sex for votes in the Florida Senate. Now, all of these accusations have set off a Senate investigation. Governor Rick Scott also has ordered state agency leaders to adopt a sexual harassment policy that includes training for workers, and lays out, Melissa, a process for reporting and investigating those complaints.
That's right, Tom. In a year with big political stories, the sexual harassment scandal under the dome in Tallahassee has dominated state politics for two straight months now, and it's even overshadowing the run-up to the 2018 legislative session. We're going to begin the hour with our look back at 2017 with this story, the Me Too movement, the silence breakers, and sexual harassment in Tallahassee, as we welcome Adam Smith, political editor of the Tampa Bay Times, Mark Caputo, a reporter for Politico, and Diane Roberts, a professor at FSU, writer and NPR commentator, and columnist for Flamingo Magazine. Diane, let's begin with you in Tallahassee. Of course, this is all the talk, but it's talk around the state, the country, and even the world, as this issue taking down Jack LaValla is certainly not an isolated incident. The floodgates have just opened on this problem of powerful men and in a few instances, women harassing in a sexual way subordinates. From where you sit in Tallahassee, as you talk to other women in the Capitol in particular, what's the conversation about this?
The conversation usually begins with, well, it's about time, because this is something that we've all known about. All the female reporters I know, including ones who covered session, say, 20, 30 years ago, have always talked about this. But, you know, it was the sort of thing that they were told to, hey, suck it up and keep going. You know, you want to play with the big boys. Female lobbyists, legislative aides especially, being among the most vulnerable. And this has been an open secret. I mean, it's the sort of thing that if you go to a cocktail party or if you just sit in certain bars, you hear about it, and sometimes you actually see it. So it's something that's not a surprise, but finally we are saying, hey, you can't do that. You can't do that.
Mark and Adam, both of you have covered session. Has this been an open secret? And if so, what was the tipping point in early November of 2017?
Well, this is Mark. We at Politico broke the story about the accusers of Jack LaValla, and it was the right time. It was the right atmosphere. But, you know, while, yes, it's an open secret, our initial story, we just quoted six women to whom we guaranteed anonymity. One of them was his eventual public accuser, Rachel Perrin Rogers. But we took a lot of shots from a lot of people, a lot of colleagues in the news media business, and a lot of folks in the fourth floor of the Capitol, the lobby corps, so to speak, people in the political consulting business who lied about our work, who said that we made this up, who then once Perrin Rogers' identity started to come to the fore, she was being outed by Senator Jack LaValla despite a confidentiality plea, they then turned on her and accused her of being a liar and the like. So it's not as if this was an easy thing to do. And I think one of the things that I learned as a white male, who by gender and by race is a member of the power structure, is just how imbalanced things are for women, for minorities, for people who are not in positions of power. And just being a little bit on the receiving end was pretty eye-opening.
And if you're just tuning in, it's the Florida Roundup as we take a look back at the biggest stories of 2017. This is a recorded program today, so we won't be taking your phone calls. Adam Smith, what about that? You know, women for millennia have been complaining about this power imbalance and being sexually harassed and assaulted. In 2017, though, it was as though the dam had just finally burst. And for the first time, women's complaints about this were taken seriously. And as Mark pointed out, there was this initial attempt in Tallahassee to sort of discount these allegations, but they were so overwhelming that it was simply not possible to do that. A threshold sort of got crossed this year, both in the state capitol and across the country and around the world. Other countries are grappling with this too.
Yeah, it was certainly not an open secret that Tallahassee and the legislature is a boys' club and in many ways sort of a boys' fraternity, sexist. I think some of the most egregious behavior was viewed as highly isolated, maybe less isolated than it really turns out to be. I think, you know, Mark points out that Politico took some shots for the anonymous sources, and I do think, you know, for better or worse, it is sort of a story of the changing media landscape, too. You've got, you know, the old line newspapers like the Tampa Bay Times or the Miami Herald, you know, wouldn't be able to go with a story based on exclusively anonymous sources. And I think Mark was right. There were a lot of people in Tallahassee that were dubious, especially when you know, the usually reliable rumor mill didn't spill out a lot of names.
Mark, how about that, though?
Adam's right to a degree. I think it partly is every media shop. Like, the Tampa Bay Times is a great paper, and Adam is one of the best political reporters in the state. But they have a different rule about sourcing than the Miami Herald does, where I used to work. Just in 2000, I believe the date was 2006, I wrote a story for the Miami Herald about then State Representative Ralph Arza using very racial, almost racist, or in some respects racist language to describe then Miami-Dade schools chief Rudy Crewe. And my first story was all anonymous people quoted. So the Herald had and still has just a different policy on sources. But I do agree with Adam is that it is certainly a different media landscape now than it was before.
Beyond different editorial standards, though, what was the tipping point here for this year, this fall, November 2017, for, as you called it, the open secret to get published on front pages and in news feeds and radio broadcasts and in television?
Well, I think it's what's important is that there was a tipping point, or probably tipping points. One is clearly the election of Donald Trump and a continuing conversation about the way that he has spoken about and to women. But down the food chain, you know, down to, good heavens, people remembering Bill Clinton and going, oh, wait, that was bad, wasn't it? And Clarence Thomas. And we remind ourselves of Anita Hill's testimony and how even people who are now seen as champions of women, like Joe Biden, didn't exactly cover himself in glory during those hearings. He kind of shut her down and other women who could have testified to Clarence Thomas's proclivities in the sexual harassment direction. We had the Alabama Senate race, which wasn't your garden variety sexual harassment. It was more like, you know, child molesting, if those accounts are true. But somehow, some way, we're starting to believe women. Women have always told these stories. They weren't believed. And the default position is still, for some people, well, she must be just trying to bring him down, or she must be being paid by, gosh, the Democrats, George Soros, the Republicans, the Koch brothers, whoever it is that pays all of us to do anything. I wish somebody would pay me to do something, but anyhow, nobody's
You're not
offering.
Getting any of that money, Diane?
No, dang it. You know, I'm ready to sell out, but nobody's, you know, making the big offer to me. But the important thing about this, and the thing I think to keep, you know, focused on, is that this is believing women is new as a general social construct. We tend to go, well, I'm sure he can't be that bad. I mean, he always seemed like such a nice guy. And we're seeing this, of course, across political lines. It's Democrats and Republicans. It's not just one kind of political person. We're seeing it in all levels of the kind of political profession, from elected office to, you know, all kinds of characters in different forms of lobbying or whatever, or political consultancies. And we're finally doubting the men instead of the women.
Right.
And whatever precipitated that, it's a good thing.
And let me ask you as a follow-up to this, as Diane, as we see this wave of resignations, men stepping down from these prominent positions, whether it's in politics or business or entertainment. In recent weeks, I've just kind of following this conversation, seen some women that write about this issue saying, get ready, that the backlash is coming to this, in the sense that because so much has been said about this, and this is forcing such a cultural reckoning, that all of us need to be expecting the next phase of this, which will be a backlash to the Me Too movement, a backlash to women finding their voice and coming forward, because increasingly some men are now saying, well, I don't even know how to behave in the workplace, or I think there needs to be more due process for some of these figures that have been accused. One accusation can now ruin a person's career. And then I see women responding back to that saying, what about all the women whose careers have been ruined by the dynamic that we had to live under in the past? And they don't have a lot of sympathy for men who are taking that tone. So
I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm sorry to man-terrupt, okay?
You just did.
I did. But
he man-terrupted.
You know, one of the things that has driven me crazy in covering this is the claim that, oh, now all it's going to take is one woman to come forward, and just based on one woman's claim, you know, a lawmaker will be removed from office. And I heard this throughout reporting this. And if you saw what happened to Rachel Perrin Rogers' reputation, how she was both publicly and privately denigrated. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I was getting at, Mark, is that women are saying we get our names dragged through the mud when we so much as try to complain, and now already there seems to be a backlash to this.
Right, I'm saying that it is ridiculous for anyone to think that this is easy for anyone to come forward, even now and even in the future.
Yeah,
well,
exactly
if
right.
You listen to some of those women in Alabama who came forward, and the death threats and the other uglinesses, and Rachel Perrin Rogers, and we could go and. Now, having said that, yes, we need to understand that this is nuanced at times. There might be a difference between a serial harasser like Harvey Weinstein, who was, you know, monstrous.
A serial
in his treatment
rapist.
Of women.
A serial rapist.
And possibly a serial rapist. And say, well, one woman almost did bring down Al Franken. I mean, yes, when the others came out. But there is a difference in my mind, and I speak as a card-carrying feminist. I hold it up, except this is radio. I don't think that what Al Franken was accused of was at the same level as what Harvey Weinstein was accused of, or indeed Jack Latvala. So we are going to have to force ourselves to think in a nuanced fashion. That doesn't excuse any of this. You know, bad behavior is bad behavior. I'm pretty sure that as humans, we can work out, you know, how you treat women professionally. Like, you could shake their hands. You can, you know, speak to them. You might even, because it's the Florida legislature where they do various clutching motions with arms and shoulders, you know, as long as you stick to elbows and shoulders, you might
be okay.
You're
on safe ground. Yeah, yeah. You'll be all right.
Adam, reach in somewhere else.
Adam
I
Smith,
think we might
let me,
call you out.
Let me bring this back to the Florida Capitol, because the accusations leveled against Senator Latvala have also brought up the dynamic, not only gender dynamics, but also the dynamic between legislators and lobbyists. And, you know, what have you witnessed in the past that this year has made you kind of rethink those interactions? And what are you looking forward in the future about that that interplay between lobbyists and legislators?
Well, I think one of the unfortunate results of this and some of the paranoia that is going on among legislators, paranoia or guilty consciences with some of the legislators, is that now you have a situation where women lobbyists don't have the same access. They already didn't have the same access. Now they have even worse access to lobbying, to legislators who let closed doors alone with a woman for fear of there might be a perception problem. So it's not necessarily the Me Too movement is in some a great thing for everybody. In other ways, it's another challenge for female lobbyists in this male-dominated culture up there.
I need to jump in about that because, that is there no pushback at all in the Capitol to saying that that is not the appropriate way to solve this problem by punishing women and denying them access to important meetings by saying, well, I just can't be alone with a woman now because I don't want to be accused. That cuts women out of being able to do their jobs effectively.
To kind of bridge your two points, I think Adam in part is referring to a story that was recently written that quoted one prominent lobbyist in Tallahassee saying that there could be a backlash and women lobbyists will have less access. Unfortunately, the story did not disclose that woman is a close ally of Jack Latvala.
Hmm. Mm.
And I found that many of the people trafficking in the lobbyist level and the consulting level in saying this is going to hurt women, oh, this is bad, all happen to be defenders, friends, supporters of Jack Latvala, and they were spreading information out there that was creating a chilling effect for women coming forward. So I'm not sure I buy the idea that there is going to be kind of permanent damage to women over this. I'm also not sure I buy the idea that all the problems in Tallahassee are going to be fixed.
Well, we've also heard stories about lobbying organizations using female lobbyists, targeting male legislators. Mark, you've seen reports on this, especially late in the session, to try to get policy and procedures moved around.
You know, men are men, people are people, we are animals, and that forgiveness for people who don't believe in evolution or whatever is there is a space between the House and the Senate on the fourth floor of the Capitol, the rotunda, where a senator or a representative will walk from one chamber to the other. And for years, lobby shops have employed attractive young women, many of them usually college attendees of FSU or graduates, recent graduates, who get the attention of the lawmaker. They, you know, and the lawmaker usually kind of stop and look, and they call these young women closers because it helps them kind of close in or close the deal.
We will continue our conversation here, 2017, the year in review. You are listening to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. 2017, Melissa, is the year most Floridians were reminded of just how vulnerable we are to Mother Nature and the damage it leaves behind. Hurricane Irma was more than twice as wide as the Florida Peninsula and just as long. Only the far western stretches of the panhandle escaped the storm in September. A third of Floridians were under orders to evacuate, including hundreds of thousands in South Florida. This is the Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez as the storm approached South Florida.
These are areas that may experience life-threatening storm surge. I cannot stress this enough. Don't wait to evacuate. You know, I know we're asking a lot of our residents. This is probably over 650,000 people.
That's a lot of people. Tom, it was just incredible how this storm affected virtually everyone in Florida. Irma, causing more than $6 billion in insured losses, and it's been blamed for at least 84 deaths. A dozen of those deaths were at a nursing home in Broward County, and they were ruled homicides caused by climbing temperatures after the facility lost power, knocking out its air conditioning. The 911 calls from the home began the day after the storm, and they continued.
911, what is your emergency?
Yes, hi. I'm calling from Hollywood Hills Rehab. I have another patient that's in respiratory distress.
You guys called already about this, or is this a new call? For
It's a new call. It's okay. For a different patient.
Different patient. Okay, I'm entering a call from dispatch now. Give me one moment.
The state issues emergency rules requiring nursing homes and assisted living facilities to have generators and fuel supplies so that they can keep temperatures at 80 degrees for at least 96 hours. So there are many lessons to be learned from the toll of Irma. And as we take a look back at this huge story for Florida, we welcome back Adam Smith, political editor of the Tampa Bay Times, Mark Caputo, reporter with Politico, and Diane Roberts, professor at FSU, writer and PR commentator and columnist with the statewide Flamingo magazine. And this is a recorded program today, everybody. We can't take your phone calls as we talk about the biggest stories of the year. Adam Smith, let's begin with you. When we try to gain some lessons from Hurricane Irma, did Florida learn that it's impossible to evacuate a third of the state in a storm of that magnitude?
Yeah, and I think we were all a little rusty. You know, it had been some years before we had
it. Yeah, really.
Put it, Adam. Yeah,
very true.
That's one way to put it.
Yeah, we were a little off our game, weren't we?
And there were a lot of fairly significant problems with the evacuations and confusion over where to evacuate and who should evacuate. But all in all, I think these hurricanes always have huge political repercussions. And it's been a big boon to Rick Scott. I think a lot of people love that image of him day after day in that Navy cap warning people to get out because their lives are at risk.
Yeah, I mean, hurricanes, if handled right by an executive, I think of Jeb Bush before Scott, they can get high marks from constituents if they do a decent job of response. And they can really get pilloried if they don't.
Exactly.
But
this is true.
We had a ping pong evacuation, though. And some of that obviously is to blame on the meteorological nature of this storm, is how it wobbled and kind of came up the West Coast instead of right up 95 ultimately. But folks in South Florida were evacuating over to Naples and then to Orlando, and folks in Tampa were evacuating to Jacksonville and then up to Atlanta. This was a pancake and a ping pong evacuation. When you had a third of the state under evacuation orders, Mark and Diane, a lot of folks were just kind of left not knowing where to go.
Well, I'm sorry to be heretical about it, but I've been through enough hurricanes, both just as a Florida resident for most of my life and as a reporter, where I think most people who have a sound enough house should stay. Too many people are ordered too often to evacuate too quickly with too dire a warning. And you're usually, I believe, and this depends on you, your capacity, and your house. People should probably stay for the hurricane, make sure your house is not destroyed, that there's not a hole in the roof that you don't have to immediately cover with a tarp, and then leave for a few days until the power comes back on.
That is not in the Our Lady of the Hurricane dogma that I have seen.
I know. And
it's in the Florida Bible,
Mark.
Everyone gets
a
copy. Yeah. I think it's even in hotel room nightstand drawers in Florida. So, yeah, you're going to have to say some rosaries or whatever needs to be done here.
I've been in Katrina, New Orleans, and Andrew in Miami. I have a familiarity with these things. And, like, these things are not as dangerous as they pretend them to be. Now, if you're right on the beach and you can get flooded, yeah, that's one thing. But if you live inland, say where I do in Miami and Coral Gables, it's not that much of a threat.
Or if you live in Tallahassee, for God's sake, you know, you really. Sorry, go ahead, Adam.
I was going to say there was sort of a mixed message. The governor was telling everybody to flee, so you had a lot of people who went to Atlanta, and so we had huge traffic jams. I think if you're in a flood susceptible area, it's maybe wiser to just go inland rather than flee for hours and hours where you could be worse off trouble getting back.
Hmm. Atlanta also lost power due to that storm, so things were not so great in Atlanta.
That's right.
I had friends that were, they had longer power outages than I did. And if you live in Tallahassee, first of all, we weren't very rusty because we had Hermine last year. And we were rusty then, and everybody this year went absolutely berserk and bought every battery for 50 miles. And, you know, we bought enough. God, there was a riot at Publix over drinking water. It was just hilarious.
Well, yeah, we had fuel shortages all throughout the state as ports had to close and they couldn't accept, you know, the ships of fuel anymore.
And
people were traveling 400 miles away and getting caught on the turnpike or 75.
I know. And also people apparently think there are only two roads in Florida, I-75 and I-95. All these people going like, I can't get out. I'm stuck on that interstate. And I was like, dude, look at a map, like a paper map, a real map, not a stupid Google map. There are lots of roads that you could get out on.
There are some back roads.
Some sense.
Yes, there are.
But, you know, to the issue of governors, you know, looking strong of jaw and resolute, that's kind of like a base minimum job you expect from any governor. What you don't want is anybody to screw it up, but kind of showing up and handing out water, it ain't rocket science, but you're absolutely right. That image of Rick Scott did him a whole lot of good. The nursing home fiasco, however, I think dented that image a little bit.
Because he gave his cell phone number out to the nursing home.
He gave his cell phone number out and
operators
nothing
before the storm.
Happened.
It hasn't
nothing
shown up in the poll. I got to say, though, it hasn't shown up in the polling.
No, it has not.
Well,
it will.
And
it'll be an issue later.
And additional reporting that came out after the fact of, you know, a big state recovery warehouse centrally located in Orlando had expired food, didn't have vendors, didn't have the proper delivery contracts, wasn't stocked after the fact. And the emergency planning review of that prior to Irma had pointed all of that out.
Yeah, nobody did anything about that. But the real problem is, I mean, I agree with Mark. I don't evacuate. I mean, why? Why? It moves slowly. You know it's coming. Unless you're in, if you're in a mobile home, you should leave. Our real problem is we just let people build any damn place they want to, like on barrier islands, which is dumb, and next to the beach, and we don't think about what is happening.
And yeah, let me follow up with Adam on that, Diane, because you know, for years now, here on public radio in Florida, climate scientists have been sounding the alarm that Florida is growing increasingly vulnerable to rising seas, stronger storms, and that eventually the cost of building in these coastal areas is going to become so prohibitive that we're going to have a really ugly reckoning about this. What about Diane's point that the state is not getting serious about looking at changes to permitting and building in some of these really vulnerable coastal areas? In fact, the building is going on at an even quicker pace than it was before we started seeing storms that just keep growing in size and strength as they cross over these ever warmer oceans when they come towards us. What about that, Adam Smith?
Well, first, I feel compelled to say that if your emergency management folks are telling you to get out of your neighborhood, get out of your neighborhood.
Know what evacuation zone you live in.
I think you're right. I'm not sure there is a will, certainly from the state level, to really put a crimp on development along the coast. What we may be facing is really an infrastructure question, that some of these cities, you know, like Miami Beach, any city on the coast, they simply may have to be investing a lot more money to raise their roads, et cetera. Because there's no question the seas are rising, and in my neck of the woods we're very susceptible to a horrible hurricane and flooding. You're already seeing what you see regularly in Miami Beach is sunny day flooding when there's a king tide.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and I've seen no other than a little bit of a change in the way officials in Miami-Dade and Broward counties look at this issue. Around the rest of the state, I don't really see much change in policy or culture or outlook.
From the top. There's no leadership. You know, we have a governor who doesn't want to engage in a discussion of climate change and possibly even tried to ban that expression, even though he goes around saying, I'm not a scientist. Well, that's fine. A bunch of climate scientists went to see him and explained it to him in words of one syllable or less, and he still isn't getting it. So I expect to see that issue arise next year when he's running for Senate.
Yeah.
Mark, I would point out that the Democrats seeing for the first time polling that shows that climate change is really an effective issue in a way that it hadn't been in prior cycles. So I do think we're going to be hearing a lot about that in the 2018 gubernatorial race.
Let me ask about one other Irma-related issue, and that's about the debris and the cleanup. Again, a whole state story here. With some communities that had pre-planning and had pre-storm preparations, Mark, and had these vendors and contracts already in place, they were usurped by other counties and other municipalities that were willing to pay much more for the trucks and for the crews to come down and do the FEMA audited kind of cleanup. And in fact, in some cases, the governor stepped in Monroe County and pushed in a contract when the county said it had already made plans for the kind of debris cleanup after a storm like Irma.
Yeah, I think you're referring to the CBS4's Jim Tafiti, right? Wrote that story about Monroe County and the governor's apparent involvement. The problem with a hurricane like Irma is it was a, pardon the cliche, the perfect storm. Hmm. It went east to west and almost north to south in the state. There was no escaping it. And so, you know, there's just a limited number of work crews that can do this. Now, there appear also to be a limited number of ethical contractors who decide, hey, even though I made this agreement, someone's paying me more, I'm going to break that agreement. So perhaps it's incumbent on counties to either discuss, perhaps to Adam's point or expanding on it, having a public works department that can handle these sorts of things, or making sure that their contracts can't be broken.
We saw that certainly up here in North Florida with historic levels of flooding, particularly in our downtown core, flooding our downtown skyscrapers, our historic neighborhoods. We're talking 6 to 7 feet of storm surge, you know, flowing into the downtown St. John's River Basin and then absolutely pulverizing entire neighborhoods, including some poor neighborhoods on Jacksonville's north side that are still struggling to recover from this. And as yet, you know, we haven't seen an aggressive response from the leadership in North Florida on some of those changes you're talking about, because certainly we can expect these storms to continue. And if you're just tuning in, this is the Florida Roundup statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. Well, 2017 was the year the state of Florida declared a public health emergency over opioids as the death toll and the cost continued rising. Dr. Valerie Rao is the Jacksonville medical examiner. Earlier this year, she talked about the horrible toll the crisis is taking right in her morgue.
We have never seen this impact on our office. We have no space. We have to tell the hospitals and the funeral homes to keep the bodies because we have no trays. We can come in on a Monday and have 9 overdoses.
9 overdoses, 9 bodies to process before the medical examiner can do anything else. And this is a regular occurrence, not just in Duval County, Florida, but around the state. As we look at the biggest stories of 2017, Tom, certainly the opioid crisis in Florida, a public health emergency, has to rank right up there. Adam Smith of the Tampa Bay Times, of course, President Trump has called this a public health emergency as well. But here in Florida, as you assess the statewide response to the opioid crisis, how do you think the state is grappling with this? Well, not well? Or is Florida struggling as much as the rest of the country with this, do you think?
I do think it's very much of a national problem, and Florida certainly is suffering significantly. I think we are grappling with it, but we've been a little late to get to it. For some years, there was a lot of opposition in the legislature, for instance, to having a database that could track unscrupulous doctors that were prescribing too many painkillers. And some of the state leaders, including Governor Scott, that were very skeptical of that a few years ago, now are all for it. So we've got a long way to go, but it's finally one of those issues that almost every family has somebody, a friend or a relative, who's been affected horribly by this.
Absolutely right. And it's incredible, too, to hear Mark Caputo, when you speak to a medical examiner, who I, a woman I spoke to in early 2017, she was literally crying out for help by saying, you don't understand, we literally can't process the bodies that are coming in to our morgue. That's how bad it is.
Right. I think Bradenton, Manatee County, had that problem, or one of them on the southwest coast. You know, one thing I think is important to bring up in this discussion, simply because it's been suppressed for quite some time. We can't say there's causation, but there appears, according to the National Institutes of Health study, a correlation between the legalization of marijuana, medical marijuana generally, but marijuana as a whole, and reduction in opiate-related deaths. Hmm. And what's interesting is that the Florida legislature has just been adamant in screwing up medical marijuana legislation and in prohibiting any sort of marijuana decriminalization.
Well, Diane, maybe Florida could be a real live experiment with what Mark is talking about in 2018.
Well, yes. I mean, I agree that somehow the Florida legislature has it in their heads that, you know, we'll all sink into complete decadence and perfidy if they legalize, you know, medical marijuana in a way that, you know, would actually help people who are in pain, whereas, you know, oxycodone is going to get you maybe some pain relief but also going to get you addicted. We have not seen that that is the case with marijuana, but there is that cultural barrier, I think. That, and they're terrified somebody's going to run against them saying, he loves drugs, you know, wants to legalize drugs, you're going to put your granny on dope. And, you know, well, granny's probably already on dope of some kind. And the problem is, as Adam says, national. It's everywhere because we have these drugs that can help with pain. And people, many, 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 many millions of people have chronic pain. The trouble is, how do you get off of that once you become, you know, stuck on relieving your back pain with some of this stuff? And Florida being, you know, a state that's grappled so hard with pill mills and other kinds of unscrupulous, you know, medical alleged practitioners, you know, we were just ripe for it. I mean, it's been going on and maybe we didn't notice, maybe we didn't know what to call it. But I think the attention to that is all to the good. Because we've got to do something about it. I'm not entirely sure declaring it an emergency is going to help.
And it is certainly one of the biggest stories of the year. We'll keep continuing to talk about those here on the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition 2017 Year in Review. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, today we are talking about some of the biggest stories around Florida in 2017. This year saw Florida make changes to how it hands out the death penalty, and the state returned to carrying out the punishment after pausing executions, Tom, for a year and a half. Florida resumed the death penalty in August with the execution of Mark James Assay, a white supremacist accused of targeting black victims. It was the country's first execution using an untested triple drug lethal injection. Those have been controversial around the country, by the way. Now, in early 2016, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Florida's death penalty sentencing system itself was unconstitutional because it was too easy for judges to override jury decisions on whether someone should be put to death. This spring, though, I don't know if folks remember this, but lawmakers changed the law requiring unanimous jury verdicts for a death penalty here in Florida.
And and separately, back in March, Melissa, the Orlando area state attorney, Aramis Ayala, held a news conference announcing that her office would no longer seek the death penalty in any murder case.
By choosing to seek life sentences over death, we can assure that violent offenders will never be released. They will never continue to drain resources from this state with decades of appeals. And we can offer families of the victims more closure and more certainty.
After her announcement, Melissa, Governor Rick Scott removed all the murder cases from her office, sending them to the Ocala area state's attorney. Now, Ayala is the state's first black elected state attorney. She sued the governor for usurping her authority by reassigning those murder cases, but the Florida Supreme Court sided with the governor, saying he did not exceed his authority. The state attorney, meantime, says that she would abide by the court's ruling and start considering death penalty case by case. hasn't happened yet. Last month, she missed a filing deadline to seek the death penalty in a new case, and that certainly got the attention of the governor's office, Melissa.
It certainly did, and we continue our discussion now about the biggest stories of the year with Adam Smith of the Tampa Bay Times, Mark Caputo of Politico, and Diane Roberts of FSU, NPR, and Flamingo Magazine. Adam Smith, this standoff between the state attorney in Central Florida and the governor, it got attention far beyond Florida, as she sort of said, oh, you know, I'm going to defy the governor's will and just simply refuse to implement the death penalty. Florida actually is an outlier among most states when it comes to application of the death penalty. The majority of states have really reduced the way they implement this ultimate punishment. So as you looked at the position of State Attorney Ayala and squaring off against the governor through a political lens, how did you view that? Because as we've been talking about, of course, Governor Scott is expected to have wider political aspirations once he leaves the governor's mansion.
Yeah, in that case, we're talking about a cop killer. So this was a very sensational case. And I think in her election, this, you know, most people don't pay attention to the elections and campaigns of state attorneys, but it's almost a sure thing that she is going to have a very tough time with her reelection because of this. You know, Florida has had lots of problems with this, with its death penalty. I think we lead the nation in terms of people who have been exonerated off of death row. But still, in a case like this, to unilaterally make that decision, clearly the politics are very much on Rick Scott's side.
Diane Roberts, what about what Adam Smith said, that even if the majority of Florida voters approve of the death penalty, some of the cases haven't been airtight. There have been exonerations. And nationally and even internationally, the death penalty is really receding as a criminal justice tool, but not here in Florida.
Well, the United States has the distinction of being amongst countries like Saudi Arabia and other places we don't like to be compared to as a country that actually executes people for crimes. It is a bizarre thing that in the 21st century we're still doing this. But having said that, it's popular. It's one of those things that, you know, we want to be tough. We seem to see no difference or no at least difficulty of declaring ourselves, many of us, declaring ourselves Bible-believing Christians and howling for blood at the same time. Aramis Ayala, I thought, did a courageous thing, but a politically pretty boneheaded thing in saying that she would not seek the death penalty. She's right in saying that death penalty appeals go on forever and cost an absolute fortune. They cost apparently a lot more than locking somebody up for life. Now, there are people that just still think you have someone that takes a life, their life should be forfeit. That's good Old Testament justice. But it's something that we should as a culture start to get really uncomfortable with, because if we look at who gets the death penalty predominantly, it's an awful lot of people of color.
Well, for the state legislature, the Supreme Court had to come in and tell the state of Florida that for years and years and years, the way it was handing out the death penalty, allowing a judge to do it, not juries, was wrong. And this legislature took two different times to try to get it into a unanimous jury verdict. The legislature was very reluctant to put it to a unanimous jury.
Oh, and that failed for years. In fact, not to sound like too much of a graybeard here, but in 2006, Miami State Senator Alex Villalobos wound up in a very tough reelection fight. One of the things used against him by his opponent in the Republican primary was that he sponsored a bill that would have allowed for or would have required unanimous jury verdicts in death sentence cases. Mm-hmm. And one of the mail pieces against him said that if Alex Villalobos had his way, the serial killer Ted Bundy would still be walking around. Understand that those are the politics of it. Yeah. So to Adam's point, you know, Rick Scott must have thought that Aramis Ayala was a secret campaign supporter by deciding to not pursue the death penalty against an accused cop killer. That's you know, in most of Florida, there is a belief that some SOBs deserve or need killing.
Let me remind folks that you are listening to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition, 2017 year in review from Florida Public Radio. Now, a controversial education law passed this spring, and it changes the way charter schools are funded. It faces plenty of challenges, though, including in court. 13 county school boards, including Broward and Duval, sued the state over this new education law. It's called HB 7069. The school districts, Melissa, argue that the law improperly undermines local control of public schools by requiring public school boards to share property tax revenues with these charter schools, privately owned charter schools. This is Lee County School Superintendent Gregory Adkins in Fort Myers back in June.
This legislation will harm our schools, cut programs to our students, and make it harder to recruit effective and highly effective teachers. House Bill 7069 takes your tax dollars and requires us to send them to for-profit corporations that run charter schools.
All right, Adam Smith, Tampa Bay Times. Can these 13 county school boards be successful in taking the state on over this matter?
Lord knows. I don't know if they can be successful, but I can tell you there's a growing amount of public opinion that thinks the state is going too far in promoting these charter schools, and I think the legislature politically probably should tread lightly. That said, I think that's a repercussion from a senator like Jack Latvala. His troubles. He's a very key player in the legislature and somebody that has been a blocker of some of these educational reforms like charter schools. So you knock him out of being effective, and that has real policy implications.
Really? Yeah, that's the discussion that we could get into a lot of areas about if Latvala goes, how that will change policy in all manner of fronts, not just education. But Diane Roberts, what about critics' long-standing pushback against standardized testing and more funds for charter schools in Florida, that it's a backdoor way to, you know, dismantle public education and expand charter schools? Proponents of charter schools see that as just an accusation that is not grounded in reality.
I don't think it's a backdoor way for them to undermine public education. I think it's flouncing in through the front door and making a lot of noise. We've been seeing this ever since Jeb Bush was elected governor. Jeb Bush has a great deal of interest in education. He has a foundation, and he really got this ball rolling. Charter schools have done nothing but expand, but there's no evidence they do a better job than state schools. And there's a lot of evidence that there's something wacky about giving taxpayer money to private corporations, for-profit corporations, all the while howling. And they're not forced to undergo the kind of testing that the public schools are, and then howling about results in public schools. I think it's absolutely outrageous that we are undermining something that's kind of the social good. I mean, people hate paying taxes to support schools. But Florida has a lot of residents that have come from elsewhere and feel that they already paid those taxes to support schools and their children aren't in the schools, so why do they care? But it's part of your social rent. And charter schools are a cancer on this system.
Bar Mark, so, let me get you. Last word here in 30 seconds.
Charter schools are publicly they are privately run public schools. They're not complete private schools. One thing I think we should all bear in mind is that one of the terrible things the legislature does is it pits the school choice community, so to speak, against the public school community. I think if you funded all adequately, we'd hear far less hue and cry, but instead,
they play
winners and losers. They pick winners and losers, and unfortunately, I think we also let some of the teachers' unions off the hook. My wife is a public school teacher here in Miami-Dade County. Some of the tales she has told me about public school teachers who are very bad, who are protected by unions, it will make your hair curl.
Yeah, it's certainly a complex issue, but as we look back on the biggest stories of 2017, we'll have to wrap it up now by thanking Adam Smith of the Tampa Bay Times, Mark Caputo of Politico, and Diane Roberts talking to us from FSU. Thank you so much for being on the Florida Roundup, and we appreciate your insights.
WLRN's program director is Peter Meritz. Our theme music is by Miami musician Aaron Libos. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening.